brought to you by WorldWrestlingInsanity.com.
A couple parrots that like to squawk, and they sound like you, and all the shit you talk. Step inside my shoes, you couldn't fill them, Doc. You're too old to kid, too soft to rock.
And now, the exciting conclusion of JG's Radio Reinsanity.
All right, great. It's always good to have Mallory on the phone lines. We plan on doing this a lot more. I want to have Matt Dogs on, Obsidian on, maybe Paul O'Brien on. So a lot of the writers are going to be joining us in the next couple of weeks. And also, if you guys are looking for guests, I can tell you this much. We're going to be having some really good guests coming in the next few weeks, too. People that... It kind of surprised me that we're going to end up getting. So you got a lot coming your way, guys. I think you'll be very excited with what WorldWrestlingInsanity.com and especially with what JG's Radio Free Insanity has coming for you guys. A lot of good stuff. Speaking of good stuff, let's talk about some bad stuff. And that's this week's Moment of Insanity. So without further ado, I'm not going to prolong it anymore. We actually have a brand new intro for it, and... Might as well just play it now. So guys, here it is. You voted for it. It's this week's Moment of Insanity.
All right, JR. Time for your colon surgery. And everyone on that, I'm Dr. Heine. I want you to meet Nurse Rockernockers.
Yeah, it wasn't my fault.
Fear is only a four-letter word.
The world's largest love machine, Viscera.
Woo! As voted by you, the readers of WorldWrestlingInsanity.com, it's this week's Moment of Insanity.
Hey, what happened?
Well, at this point, you would normally hear the intro music, but since this is the first Moment of Insanity... for JG's Radio Free Insanity, we didn't play any music because the opening to our Insanity intro is actually this week's Moment of Insanity, and it's Dr. Heine, Vince McMahon, mocking Jim Ross's bowel surgery in a prolonged and painful segment on Raw. And I think the irony of the whole thing is that if I was actually having bowel surgery, it wouldn't have been as painful as watching the skit that Vince McMahon made everyone sit through. For those of you guys not keeping up and wondering what's going on, I'll tell you what's going on. Jim Ross was involved in an angle on TV where he was fired by World Wrestling Entertainment. And now, in the prevailing weeks, Jim Ross has had surgery, colon surgery, to fix his insides. And Vince McMahon went on TV on Monday and did a skit where he pulled things out of a fake ass. Things like, oh, Jim Ross's head is in his ass, and there's a football in his ass, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I don't know, guys. I think this was... It was probably one of the most distasteful things WWE has done on TV in a long time. And now look, I'm going to set a couple of things straight as far as how I feel about this angle and how a lot of people feel about this angle. If you do yourself a favor and check out, again, I'm going to pimp it again, but it's because it's topical. Tom Pritchard did a column last night where he talked about the Jim Ross angle a little bit too and his feelings on it. Here's my feelings on it, okay? Jim Ross was put in a position on TV where he was told, look, we're looking to phase you out, obviously, because time goes on and time does move on, and we really shouldn't come down on WWE for wanting to update various parts of their product. If anything, I'm glad they're looking to update certain parts of their product. I wish that they would have started somewhere besides the announce team. I wish they would maybe change the look of Raw, or change the ring, or change the colors, or change the goddamn theme song, something like that, but they didn't. They want to go Raw's first, and that's cool. They want to change the announcers. I get it. It makes sense. So I think I'm fairly sure WWE approached Jim Ross, told him, look, you have surgery coming up, we are looking to phase you out, let's do an angle on TV where you are let go, and you are, you know, fired on television, we'll make it a big thing, and, you know, the internet fans love you so much, so they'll make a big stink out of it, and it'll be cool, and it'll get us some free pub. Alright, so I get that. That's all fine, well, and good. It was originally started as a work. It may end up being a shoot by the end and that Ross might not be brought back. Things change daily. So when somebody comes out and they say, well, this is exactly what's happening, this is exactly what's not happening, I don't know if that's entirely true because, to the best of my understanding, no one outside the McMahon family really knows what's going on here, including the people involved in the angle. I don't think Jim Ross is fully aware of what's going on. It's the kind of thing where someone is told one thing. I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this to you guys. It would be the sense of somebody saying to you, look, we're going to play a trick on our friend here. We're going to pretend like you went crazy, okay? And what we're going to do is you're going to go nuts, and then you're going to disappear for a little while. And we'll play a trick on our friend and be like, oh, you know, Bobby went crazy, ha ha ha. So you do that, and you play along with the game, and you say, okay, hey, look, I'm crazy, and then you leave, and you're gone for a while. And then while you're gone, your friend proceeds to stab you in the back over and over again, saying things about you and saying nasty things about you. That's what's happening here. Jim Ross is now off television. Jim Ross is out of sight, out of mind. And while he is out of sight, out of mind, unable to go on TV and rebut anything, Vince McMahon has taken this angle, and he's having fun with it. And he's doing whatever the hell he wants to do with it. And that's where the skit came from on Monday. It's not the kind of thing where Jim Ross is like, oh, you know, you guys should totally, you know, make fun of me and make fun of my bowel surgery on TV. And you know why I'm saying that? Not because Jim Ross is one of those people that's going to get so deeply offended by it, but this isn't a Jim Ross thing. Jim Ross isn't the type of person who watches wrestling and likes skits like that. I mean, you could tell in wrestling which people are supporters of silly shit like that, which people aren't. And in this case, you know, Jim Ross is not the kind of person who likes stupid things like that. So to really think that this has Jim Ross's full blessing, you're kind of kidding yourself. Unless Jim Ross has changed 180 degrees in the last 2 months and had bowel surgery, and when he had bowel surgery, they implanted a chip in his brain that said, you like stupid wrestling skits. Let them make fun of you. This is definitely the kind of thing where one person got someone else to do something and got him off TV for a while, and in his absence mocked him. And that's what it's come down to, and I think that a lot of people have a hard time realizing that there is that mean-spirited nature in WWE. I mean, it's always been there. It's the kind of thing that you see on TV, but you try to convince yourself that it doesn't exist. You try to convince yourself that in wrestling, everything is either 100% work or 100% shoot. And you know what? A lot of times, it's not like that. A lot of times in wrestling, especially when you're dealing with people who are looking to either iron grudges out, put themselves over, get free publicity for themselves, you're going to have to deal with people who are going to start situations as a work and change it into a shoot, and vice versa. Same thing with Matt Hardy. Matt Hardy, when he came to WWE and started doing all that stuff with Lita and calling Edge a feces and everything, was really making a lot of waves for World Wrestling Entertainment. So what did they do? They turned it into an angle. Why did they turn it into an angle? Because they love Matt Hardy? No. Because they thought they would make a ton of money off the feud? No, because they didn't make a ton of money off the feud. If anything, Matt Hardy now is back to where he was before. WWE did it to defuse the situation. To say to him, look, Matt, you want to make a name for yourself? That's great. You know what? We're going to pull you in, and we're going to make it seem like we came up with the whole idea. We're going to have people questioning whether or not this thing is even real, and then we're going to throw you back into the garbage at the end of the day. And that's what the business is all about. It's all about that confusion, that confusing line between what is a work and what is a shoot, between what is going to happen and what's not going to happen tomorrow, and I'll tell you why that is. WWE right now has all the cards in their hand. WWE has the ability to make decisions on the drop of a dime that we can't even fathom beforehand. In other words, they could turn around today and say, Jim Ross is never coming back. Start spreading the rumors, spread it around their office, and have people report it all over the place. Jim Ross is never coming back. And Vince McMahon tomorrow can call Jim Ross and say, come back, we want you back on Raw, and he'll be back. And then they'll laugh at you. And they'll say, we were going to bring him back the whole time. It happens all the time. WWE does this a lot. And the reason why is because they can. And when you're in a position where you are the number one company in North America for a genre of entertainment that has been around since the dawn of freaking time, you have that ability. And you have the ability to confuse people and keep your fans guessing. That's what they're doing here. Rest assured, Monday night was not part of some intricate storyline planned out to sell you anything. Because honestly, even if you love the bowel skit, with the exception of WWE's auction where they sold all that crap online afterwards, what else were you supposed to buy after watching that? Did it sell you a match? Did it sell you an angle? Did it sell you a story? Did it sell you a character? It sold you nothing. All it was a mean-spirited way of WWE to send a message to Jim Ross and to its employees to get your head out of your ass. And how did they do it? Well, they did it on USA Network. And they did it while you watched. And they did it to piss you off. Vince McMahon's way of saying, I can do whatever I want, when I want. And you know what? If the backlash gets huge, if this was a normal company, I would say, oh, they'll bring Jim Ross back. I don't think they will. I think McMahon, he thrives on things like this. He thrives on that opposition. He thrives on the fact that people treat him in a negative way. Because to him, and to a lot of people in this business, it comes down to negative attention is attention nonetheless. And that's just the way he goes with it. And I think the problem that Vince McMahon is going to run into, especially with the storyline, because I think the storyline is really hurting him and his company, this isn't about hating the Mr. McMahon character. And this isn't about people being mad that this Mr. McMahon character did this skit on Monday. At the end of the day, everybody who watches wrestling realizes that money goes into Vince McMahon's pocket. And I think a storyline like this is going to make people think twice about whether or not they want to give Vince McMahon their money and whether or not they want Vince McMahon really to benefit from doing things like this to people. Just blows my mind. Yeah, you know, you guys agree too. I got a lot of emails on this. I'm going to read just one for now. Next week we're going to start doing this full force again, but it was Team Bring It, TBI, right here in our message boards, who really, I mean, she summed it up, so I'm just going to read hers. And remember, guys, start voting now. Next week I could read yours. And she says, I never thought I'd see the day where I debated whether or not to continue watching wrestling. Well, my time has come. I was lucky enough to see WWE.com version of the JR skit from Shit. That's funny. But I wish that I could have had that 2 minutes of my life back. Not one part of that skit was funny. Not one part of that skit was used to advance a feud. Not one part of that skit made any type of sense to anyone whose name isn't McMahon. JR is a fucking announcer. He's not a wrestler in any sense of the word. So to have an entire skit dedicated to making fun of him is pointless. And the time that was spent showing the skit, the hurricane angle, that's shown on WWE.com could have aired nationally. Good point. I have so many complaints, but throughout them all, I get brought back to this thought. I mean, did the McMahon seriously sit and think of this crap every week? I can't imagine someone actually sitting at a table and writing down, okay, so when you put the drill in the puppet's ass, do you want farting noises with that? I'm really sickened by this stupid skit, and this is coming from someone who liked Al Wilson. Wow. I wonder if the devil has a bed ready in hell for Vince McMahon, because that's certainly where he's headed. Well, there you go, guys, and I think she put it best. I think at this point, WWE has alienated its fans to the point where it's not wrestling heat anymore. This is the kind of heat where people are genuinely offended, not because Jim Ross is being mocked, but because we're being mocked. And we're being mocked by Vince McMahon thinking that we are a captive audience, and thinking that he can put whatever he wants on a show and iron out his grudges while we watch. And I don't know. It's really a sad way to run your industry. Too much scripting, too much garbage, but that's this week's moment of insanity, is the skit from hell with Vince McMahon as Dr. Heine. So there you guys have it. Yeah, I mean, and we're talking now about scripting things and things being scripted and over-scripted, but there was actually a guy that really was on top of this business back when it wasn't about scripts, and it was more about the persona of a wrestler and whether or not that person could hold that persona down and get the fans to hate them for who they are, not for what they're reading off of a piece of paper. And that guy's name is Nick Bockwinkle. So we want to welcome him to the show. Come on, everybody, join me in welcoming Nick Bockwinkle. Nick, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, sir.
All right. I mean, a couple of questions. I know our readers are dying to have some questions for you. One of the first things I want to ask you, we were talking a little bit before we went on the air here, about your history in the business and a lot of the things that you've seen and done. If you had to really pick one thing that you've seen or done within this industry that stands out in your mind above all else, what would that be?
Oh, gosh.
Gotcha.
That's a tough one. Because I was very fortunate to be second generation, and I guess it would be the first time I went into the ring. It was more startling for me than anything else. I was, I'd say about 5 and a half, maybe 6 years old, and I was sitting on a stage in Galveston, Texas, and my dad was wrestling, and this would have been in the late 30s, early 40s. And I heard somebody yell, "Get Nikki!" And about that time, somebody grabbed me and they carried me to the ring. And the building was a civic building, which was like a theater, big theater with a stage up on. I was sitting back on the stage. And they could put, you know, the chairs around, and they had a big balcony for civic affairs and things there. And they had wrestling there. And they put me in the ring, and they picked me up to the ring, and they said, get in there and pick them up. And I kind of looked around. I'm startled, you know. And what it was the ring was covered with pennies, nickels, and dimes. And so I got in there, and I started picking them up. And, of course, the reason they were in there is because when the people showed their displeasure in, say, 1939 or 1940, they would throw pennies, nickels, and dimes in, like, well, we'll pay the referee. This way he'll be honest. It was their sarcastic gesture, so to speak, to what just had taken place. And so I got in there, and I had this huge handful of money I was holding up against my chest, and it was starting to spill over, and I was like, well, what do I do now? So then finally I walked over to the corner, and I knelt down, and I bent over, and I put this little pile of money, and when they saw that I had found a way I was going to collect it at my little banking spot, and I went out to get the rest, it started them all over again. And ultimately they had to come in with a broom and sweep it all up. And that was my first payday, but I don't know what I got.
I mean, was it different for you back then? I know nowadays you have second-generation wrestlers and third-generation wrestlers that kind of almost benefited from having their parents within the industry because people kind of knew it was a worked thing. For you, especially in that time period, was it different for you having a dad who wrestled as far as how other kids and people would treat you?
Ironically, there wasn't that much television back then, needless to say, in the 40s, you know, and so then I went to high school in 1949. I was 14 then. And so in high school there was one guy, big guy, and by this time I'm a junior, and he kept needling me about my father being a phony wrestler. And finally, I said to my dad, I said, gee, Dad, I says, I'm about 16 years old at this time, 15 years old, and I knew how to wrestle a little bit. You know, I had all these guys always put holes on me all the time. And so this guy was kind of the big high school bully, and he was as big as I was, and I weighed about 180 pounds at the time. And I said to my dad, I said, well, I don't know about the guy. He said, well, do you think if you got him on the mat, you could handle him? And I said, possibly, you know. He said, well, I'll tell you what you do. He says, you go get this coach, and he knew them by their names, the football coach and the assistant football coach. And he says, you tell him that you want to get on the mat with this guy, and you don't want anybody in the gym except you, him, and the two coaches. And he says, and just say, that's the way it'll be. And so I went and I talked to the two coaches first, and they kind of said, okay, you just let us know when. So then one day, this guy's coming up the stairs, and I'm going downstairs to the next class, and he's got a couple of his buddies with him, and I got maybe one or two with me. And he makes a snide remark again about my dad. And I says, you know, I says, why don't we go do some of that phony wrestling then? And I says, you and I said, we'll go to the gym and get on the mat and do it. And he says, okay. I says, mind you, only one thing. I says, it'll be Coach Blanky and Coach Smith. And I says, there'll be you and there'll be me. And none of your friends and none of mine. Just you and I and the two coaches. And when I said that to him, I could see this change of look on his face. It's almost like he wanted the audience.
Uh-huh.
And without the audience, I'm not sure he had faith in himself or whomever or whatever, but my dad always said, when you speak honestly to another person, and he says, you don't blink your eyes, he says, you wait, and he'll blink. Because he's the one that's bullshitting.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
And he says, you're not. And I've always remembered that. And so that was you know, kind of the beginning to where I started getting a handle on a lot of people and my dad. And he was the coolest guy in the world, but I never realized it until I was much older.
Yeah, most of us don't.
He was really smooth. Had a handle on all of it.
So I guess I mean that definitely sounds like a lesson that came in handy, being in
the business. Yeah, it did.
No.
Yeah, because you know there are so many blowhards and so many egos, and you had to know how to handle them. And somebody asked me one time, they said, "What do you think was your biggest asset that you had, being that you learned and you know being as successful as you were?" And I says, "It was my diplomacy. You had to understand what all the creatures were like, what they wanted, what they didn't want, what they liked, what they didn't like, and you had to work with it. You had to work with and around them, through them, on them, for them, and they had to do the same for you. Otherwise, you couldn't get the product produced."
Yeah. You had a hand.
When you stop and think about it, isn't that kind of apropos for just about living in life?
Mm-hmm.
No matter what kind of job you got.
Oh, definitely. Definitely, you have to. I mean, at some point or another, you have to stroke egos, and you have to deal with people accordingly when need be.
Oh, absolutely. With no question. Absolutely. And I think when you look at the sons that followed in the profession, DiBiase, you start going through the list of names of those guys whose fathers went before them. They had the same thing happen to them that I had, and that was osmosis. We were there, we saw it, we felt it, we heard it. We knew when other guys were bullshitting. I remember one time I was in a dressing room, and I was maybe like 12 years old. Hmm. And my dad had just worked, he came in the dressing room, and started to take his boots off, and somebody came in, and I don't know if he was a promoter, a booker, or just another wrestler, or the local smartass, but he made some kind of a comment, and when he made the comment to my dad, I heard the whole locker room just go quiet. And I looked around real quick, and my eyes, they were all looking at the door, at this guy that was standing there. And my dad just kind of kept unlacing his boots, and in the silence he said, "I want to thank you very much." And you can see the quizzical look on this guy's face. He says, "It's not often that I get inspired." And immediately I saw a lot of eyebrows raise, like, "Oh shit, this guy just put his foot into it." And that's that was so cool. You know, I mean, my dad, whoever the guy was, and I wish I would have known, but I mean, he just boom, shut him down. And the guy left, you know, and then the conversation picked up. But, you know, how to handle people is one of the toughest things you got to do.
Well, in wrestling, it's funny because you guys not only have to deal with the egos of each other and the egos of promoters, but you also have to deal with really just arrogant outsiders that don't fully understand the business. I mean, how do you deal with people like that, especially through the years, who never really fully understood what you did and looked down on it to your face?
If they were a jerk and an asshole, and depending on how brash they would be, I in turn would be just as brash if I had to be. I always like to try to take the high road and just put the idiot in his place, if I could, basically, with a few words. And so when I would get the occasional, "Well, it's all phony," I'd say, "Please, step right up." I says, "I have a free phony body slam to give you right at this moment." And I says, "And since it doesn't hurt, God bless you, come on. Come on, you step right up." And they go, "Well, no. I says, no. I said, "I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a 50% discount." I says, "I'm going to drop you from 3 feet instead of 6 feet. And then I just look at the guy and I say, please, you know, have you got something to say? You know, and they'd have to just back off. You know, and so that was the way you had to handle them. Mm-hmm. And if they were really absurd, you just ignored them, walked away.
One of the things in your career, you had a hand in kind of getting a lot of people started before they really went on to huge things. Most notably, I'm sure you get asked about it all the time, is Hulk Hogan, who you worked with right before he went to WWF and did his big thing. What was that like, and were you surprised by what he ended up being after leaving the AWA?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, he was back in New York before he came to the AWA.
No, I mean, were you surprised by how big he actually got in New York the second time around?
No, the movie came out with him and Stallone, and mind you, if you've got a giant killer and you don't have any giants, then it's, you know, eh. So here Hogan comes along, and he looks like a giant killer. And fortuitously, you had myself, you had Stevens, you had a whole slew of the Road Warriors. You had a whole slew of great talent for him to sink his teeth into, so to speak. And so, you know, I had no doubts whatsoever that he was going to be as big as he was. And one thing, I always measured certain guys a certain way, and that was that I would always ask the seconds, if the locker rooms were separate, to go over and see how warmed up my opponent was. And so they come back over and they tell me, well, you know, you've got a good sweat going, man, and he's ready to go. And I had some who would be totally cold, go into the ring, and then slowly warmed up in the ring. But when they came back and they said, he's got a good sweat, man, and he's ready to go, which Hogan always did, I respected that. And that's what I, in a sense, liked. And the reason I like that is because all of a sudden we're going to be dumped on the racetrack. And that's a quarter mile, so to speak. And if you're not warmed up by that time, and you haven't revved up your engine, and you haven't got the oil flowing to all your cylinders, and if it happens to start real fast, you got to be able to go real fast. And Hogan always was. So he was very professional. He was professional about his interviews, professional about his body, professional about how much effort and energy he was willing to expend in the ring. So I never had a problem getting in the ring with him.
Do you think he gets a bad rap from people?
Pardon?
Do you think he gets a bad rap from a lot of people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, whether it was Bruno or whether it was him or Bob Backlund or whoever it was that was the champion, there's always going to be those who are going to knock that person. And so what? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just, you know, mm-hmm. always consider the source.
Yeah, he can go home and cry on his money at the end of the day anyway, right?
No, but I mean, just like I say, yeah, you can do that. I mean, of course, that's always an answer. But I mean, you got to consider the source, who's asking the question, and why, you know.
Exactly. Well, another guy that you worked with prior to going to WWF was Bobby Heenan, who you had a great chemistry with. He served as your manager. I mean, what was that like, really, just when he was Pretty Boy Bobby Heenan, very young in his career? What was that like working with him?
Bobby Heenan was, as far as I'm concerned, the world champion of managers. Bobby Heenan, this is ironic. On the occasion, Stevens and I, we go to Denver. My plane's late, he's coming from someplace else or whatever, and they say, ladies and gentlemen, we have a championship tag match this evening, but Mr. Stevens' plane has been delayed. And you hear all the boos, and then they'd announce, they'd say, but Stanley Blackburn, president of the U.S. Wrestling Association, has been contacted, and you are still going to have a championship match tonight because Mr. Bockwinkel is going to have to defend the title with his manager, Bobby the Heenan, so it will be an official championship match. I mean to tell you, that building popped as loud as if you had said, whoever the best person in the world could have been for my partner, because Bobby was that complete of a contribution. He was as good a performer in the ring as Stevens or myself.
Definitely. Well, he was actually, I mean, they had him working, WWF had him working shows until, you know, towards the very end of his time there. One of the the Ultimate Warrior DVD just came out, and he's one of the matches on there in his weasel suit showing things like that. I mean, do you think that someone like that in the industry, somebody who had the ability to speak for wrestlers and to not just speak for wrestlers, but speak with wrestlers and kind of add to their persona, do you think that's something that's lacking today in wrestling as far as mouthpieces and managers to help guys?
Well, they say that, you know, New York's got writers. One of the things that took place back then was whatever the natural talent was that people had. And that was the big thing there. And Bobby just had natural talent, natural wit. He was one of the funniest people in the world because he could just see things and knew what kind of statements to make without thinking about it. It was always off the top of his head. I mean, and he was that witty, and he was that sharp, and he was just that witty and that sharp. Even if he was in the ring, six-man tag match, just two of us, or if he had to get in the ring himself. I mean, he's probably as brilliant a mind as this profession, I think, has ever had.
Do you think, though, that nowadays, you talked about the writers, do you think that with things being scripted kind of as heavily as they're getting to be, do you think it's kind of stifling a lot of the creativity of young guys so that we're kind of...
No question about it. No question about it. I mean, you know, Vince, I think, is what I would call a quantitative man. Mm-hmm. And bigger, better, more... there's nothing wrong with thinking in that way, but in the sense that it has forced him to rely, quote, on people doing some dialogue and writing some scripts, I think might have done just what you said, has created these guys to not push themselves or not try to expand on themselves and not be their own personas, and whatever kind of persona that they created might be even greater than whatever somebody could write for them.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
very much so.
But did you see a lot of that? One of the stints that I do remember you doing was when you were WCW commissioner in the early 90s. And from what I remember creatively at that time, there was a lot of craziness going on in the company. What was that like for you to be in that environment, having come from kind of the old school mentality of wrestling, and to kind of be here in WCW in the early 90s where it was kind of cartoony, but in almost a weird way? How did you feel about being in that world?
Well, let's put it this way. If you're going to add some class or something... Mm-hmm. Hopefully, it's all going to be a plus.
Makes sense. That makes total sense.
Mind you, mm-hmm. I understood the nature of the beast. I understood the nature of what was taking place at the time. And, you know, I was making a living, too. So, you know, what was wrong with that?
No, but I mean, was it different to adjust to kind of how the business had changed? Because you had been, at that point, you had been out of the locker room for a couple of years by then. Was it a big difference? Was it something that you saw coming? Did you know that the business was going to change and be like that eventually?
Yeah, you knew it was changing. You could see it was changing. You knew that, when Vern was, of course, the AWA going into the towns that I had mentioned to you and told you about, everybody knew that Channel 17 or Channel 18 down in Atlanta, because when I was working in Atlanta in 1969 and 70, at that time, that was what, Channel 18? And it went across the United States, but it didn't go that far north. And so everybody was becoming very, very aware of what TV was going to come into real quick.
So do you think it was a matter of just Vern didn't have as much passion as Vince did, or didn't have as much energy as he did at the time?
I would say that. I would say that. I had dinner with Vern, about 2 months before I retired. And when I retired, it was a very quiet thing. He was the only one that knew it. And And I had dinner with him, and I said to him at his house, and I said to him, I says, if, and by this time, Vince was being very proactive, and everybody knew that. And I said, if you've got something in mind that you're going to do, I'm going to say you're going to take a couple of $1 million and spend it and make sure that whatever it is, give it a good shot. Because I said, this guy, he's young, he's eager, he doesn't care about what the old guidelines were or the old rules. And I said, that is, give it your best shot now. And I said, if it goes, fine. It's just something competitive and the two of you can get together and work something out. Or if you can't, I said, at least you will have made an effort. And then just go enjoy your grandchildren. And that's what I told him. And I think what you said, he didn't have the energy to do what Vince had. Vince was hot. He was eager. He just wanted to do this thing so bad. He'd been dreaming about this for years. And plus, he was inherited one of the best territories in the country because he was son of his dad, you know. So in that respect, my God, the nucleus of what he had to work with, which was the center of the television industry, per se, New York, I mean, he was going to be a hard man to beat no matter who won against him.
Exactly. One of the other questions I wanted to ask you, because I found this very interesting, as far as wrestling history goes, and rewriting it and people changing it as time goes on, I don't even know if you're aware of it, but the AWA or whatever the AWA is now is recognizing Hulk Hogan as a former AWA champion. It was announced on their website a while ago. How do you feel about that, about people changing history as time goes on to suit different things?
Well, I would imagine it's just very much what goes on in life, regardless of what it is. You know, you look back, 1941, there was a thing called Pearl Harbor. Then in just a couple of years ago, you had what took place in New York. So here are these people who attacked us back in 1941 in Pearl Harbor, who we now get along with fantastically. We have all sorts of businesses, blah, blah, blah. And what profoundly can you expound on in respect to that? Except here's a little bit of history going through life, and it's the same way with the wrestling profession. It was what it was. It was something different way back, and now it's where it's at. And these changes were coming, and ultimately, you know. There were other people that saw that it was going to be national TV at one time. And you'd like to be able to take the best period of time when somebody enjoyed life at its very smoothest, most wonderful moment and hold it there forever. It just doesn't happen. And there are changes that come along constantly. And you got to live with it, go with it, do what you can to change it if you feel you must, or somehow or another, just don't drag yourself up a wall, you make a fool out of yourself.
Well, I guess I got to ask you the obligatory question that I guess you get asked a lot. If you could wrestle anybody today that's in the business that you didn't get a chance to wrestle when you were active, who would that be?
I would say I'd love to have a match with Kurt Angle. I'd like to have a match with Shawn Michaels. I'd like to have a match with any of the Guerreros. There are so many talents that when I do turn on the wrestling and I watch it, there are so many that command my respect and command my admiration. And God bless. I mean, the bumps that these guys take today make it look like we were just big wimps. the chances they take when they go in the ring. And I mean, I remember one night when I think it was Guerrero and Kurt Angle, I think, this was going back 2 years ago, maybe three, and I was sitting watching the match, and I'm screaming and yelling in the living room. My wife says, "What are you watching?" I says, "Wrestling." And she says, "And it's got you that going?" I says, "Hey, talk to you later." And, I mean, the match was just dynamic. Dynamic, and that's why I had to chuckle, because when Vince said, you know, he says, "Well, we're trying to make some changes, this or that," and so that when Shawn Michaels and Kurt Angle had this match this last June 26th when they were here for a pay-per-view, when I'm standing way back in the auditorium watching it, and the reaction that the people were giving, it was a match of old. Yeah. And I mean, and they were having a great match, and so you know, a great match today is a great match at any time, as a great match back then is a great match today.
Yeah. See, do you think that stuff is that? I mean, that's universal. I mean, even with bad writing, no matter how scripted it gets, you can't really script too much in between the ropes.
Yeah, movies, whatever, movie stars, entertainers, concerts, whatever. You know, they all have hit their high notes or their high marks, or their certain nights. I mean, what they perform is just outstanding, and it might not be them for another 6 months before they do it again. But I mean, of course, singing and that is another form of entertainment. But I mean, it's not as difficult, comparatively speaking, when you're asking these people to do something with their bodies that incorporates motivating the entire audience in the building.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the last things I want to ask you, as somebody who's seen as much as you have in this industry, if you could talk to a young wrestler who's just getting started, what advice would you give him that you think would be most helpful?
Well, I think I'd have to say, physically, you have to know all the mechanical moves. I said, that's a must. And then I would say, think of a persona that would be comfortable for you. And I says, and perfect it to the point that it catches the eye of everybody else. Mind you, like you said a little earlier, the writer's trying to do things, you know, they're relying on their brilliance of intellect to write certain things on paper and then give it to somebody and say, okay, now you do this. It might be better if you had some people who really had talent and personas, and they could show that persona and that talent, and then have the writers try to improve it for them. So, you know, and then it's like you said earlier, you know, they don't think they have to have a persona, and yet you do.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely.
I mean, like I talked to the Crusher's daughter this morning, because he just passed away. And we were laughing and chuckling on the phone because the Bruiser and the Crusher. The Crusher, as far as being a performer in the ring that was smooth and dynamic, not at all. And yet, he had a persona that was just, they paid to come see him.
Yeah. That's what he did. I guess, I mean, the final thing I guess we'll go to, I mean, I know that you're active with the Cauliflower Alley Club, if you want to talk about that, and just any final words for our listeners out there.
God bless them all. I'm glad that they're listening, and wish to, hopefully there are more. Prefer cash instead of compliments.
Nick, I want to thank you so much for coming on, and we'd love to have you on again soon. Thanks again, man.
All right, guys, so that's going to wrap it up for us this week. I want to thank Nick Bockwinkel, Mallory Molling for both being on the show. I want you guys to rest assured we have a lot planned, so you don't want to miss next week's show. Trust me, you don't want to miss next week's show. We'll actually be announcing our guests probably fairly early in the week, hopefully. Knock on wood, if all goes well. And we should be good to go. But until we next meet, I want you guys to make sure you check out WorldWrestlingInsanity.com and all the features that we are adding daily. There is plenty to come, and
definitely no shortage of ways to have fun on this site. So until we next meet, guys, this is James Gubbin saying thank you for listening. Be well, and always speak your mind.
Brought to you by WorldWrestlingInsanity.com.